This is the third day of this July 2009 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from the collection of teachings of ancient Chinese Zen masters from the book Zen Essence, translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. We were reading yesterday from the teachings of Lin Qi. Here's a very short one. I have no doctrine to give people. I just cure ailments and unlock fetters. Before Chan in China, Buddhism was a lot about doctrines and scholastic teachings. This is what was so radical about Zen, is the insistence that the truth, reality, is not something that you can express in words. Zen teachers use words to point to the truth, but ultimately there is no formula or dogma, because as soon as it is in words, then it's an abstraction. Truth can't be an abstraction. The word itself, truth, sounds pretty abstract, but it has to be a living thing. So this is a fundamental principle in Zen, is that there is no thing, no answer to give people. It is one's own. It is one's own authentic understanding that must be. The Buddha himself, we're told, refused to make any statements about how things are out there as an abstraction. Any true understanding has to be through practice. It has to be practical. It has to be of the body. And so we have Doksan, where one must demonstrate, physically demonstrate. Physical can include words, speech. Speech is physical. And because it is a matter of this moment in this context with this here now, it will be different for different students, different people. Of course, there's an underlying essence to all this, but it's not in the form of a doctrine. An essence that is common to all of us. And then he goes on. When I say there is nothing outside, students who do not understand me interpret this in terms of inwardness, so they sit silent and still, taking this to be Zen Buddhism. This is a big mistake. If you take a state of unmoving clarity to be Zen, you are taking ignorance as a slave master. Well, ever since the Buddha himself sat beneath the Bodhi tree, in our tradition we have sat as a way of quieting the waves of the mind, waves of thought, so that we might see things as they are. Of course, Lingzhi himself did this. His point is it's not limited to this, not limited to sitting. Not by a long shot. We hear this. We hear this. I say this over and over in Taisho, and yet it's such a stubborn notion people have that practice means sitting. People sometimes get the idea they don't want this job or that job because they don't want it to interfere with their practice. And they mean sitting. But that is a very narrow, pinched understanding of Zen, that it's just sitting. Our practice has to be all the time, in everything we do, bringing this mind of stabilized awareness into our every movement, our every word, every waking moment. The next Chinese master is Yangshan. In the back of this book, Zen Essence, there is an afterword with very brief notes about these various teachers. For Yangshan, the translator says, he was noted as one of the great geniuses of Zen, and many high officials called themselves his disciples. And he figures in quite a few koans, certainly in the collection called the Shoyo Roku, and also some in the Blue Cliff record. Here's a real good one by Yangshan. Just get the root. Don't worry about the branches, for someday you will come to have them naturally. If you have not attained the basis, even if you consciously study, you cannot attain the outgrowths either. Well, in terms of Zen practice, the branches could be any of the many things associated with our tradition, the Buddhist philosophy, psychology, the various benefits of practice, calm, development of energy, the refinement of the personality and character, even mental powers, strength, self-confidence. These are the branches, the leaves and the branches, but they really grow naturally out of the cultivation of the root. What's the root? It's this. seeing through phenomena. That's the root. Seeing that in their essential nature, things are no things. There is no fixed substance to anything we can touch or imagine. Phenomena are evanescent. They're without any fixed, permanent character to them. And so the root also is this practice that we're doing that reveals this fundamental truth. You could also say the root is seeing through all forms, seeing through self and other, us and them, all dualisms. And then from that realization of the oneness, the unity of all things, comes the mastery in many other aspects of these, the branches, the leaves and the branches. You should turn your attention within. Don't memorize my words. You have been turning from light to darkness since before you can remember, so the roots of your subjective ideas are deep and hard to uproot all at once. This is why I temporarily use expedience to take away your coarse perceptions. Don't memorize my words. Don't attach to form. We have been turning from light to darkness since before we can remember. Getting tangled in objects, mental objects. So these ideas, these objects become hardened, and deeply set, difficult to uproot, which means to see through. This is why I temporarily use expedience to take away your coarse perceptions. Expedience might mean expressing the teaching in a contradictory way, different from the way it's always been expressed before, in a paradoxical, nonsensical way. Expedience can mean any number of devices that are meant to break up our patterns. And then there are the traditional secondary practices of bowing, the prostrations, the rituals, ceremonies, robes, and the different elements of practice, the teisho, doksan. Even sesshin itself is an expedient. There is no essence in sesshin that isn't everywhere else, too. We just have we arrange the conditions so that we can see into the mind, but it could also be seen into outside sesshin. It's seen to more easily when the conditions are as settled and quiet is this. And there's always the danger of getting attached to the forms, the rituals. There's a story I'm sure many of you have heard before, but it's short. This is from a collection of stories called Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, Parables of the Spiritual Path from Around the World. When the teacher sat down to sit each evening, the original Hindu. When the guru sat down to worship each evening, the ashram cat would get in the way and distract the others. So he ordered that the cat be tied during evening worship. After the guru died, the cat continued to be tied during evening worship. And when the cat died, another cat was brought to the ashram so that it could be duly tied during evening worship. Centuries later, learned treatises were written by the guru's scholarly disciples on the liturgical significance of tying up a cat while worship is performed. In our practice of Zen here in the West, we are always facing the challenge of adapting the essence of this tradition without clinging to the forms that may not be suitable, forms from a different part of the world, a different century. It's an ongoing work in progress. At one of our annual Zen teachers meetings, at the end of the meeting, we all came to the consensus that really what we're all doing is trying to understand how to suitably adapt Zen to Western culture, and more specifically to the United States in this case. Or as Roshi Kapil used to say, without throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Preserving what is essential, but letting everything else go. Well, some have argued that what is essential is the sitting and nothing else. Let everything else go. But, as we just heard from Linchi, these secondary practices, the forms, can be enormously helpful in getting to the essence. They just have to be the suitable forms for us at this time. And different Zen centers, Zen temples, will naturally find their way to differences in these secondary practices, different forms. It's one of the other discoveries we have through these annual meetings, is to see that there are, of course, differences from even within one country, differences in forms, schedules, practices, policies. The next master is Zen Master Fa Yen. There's a little bit about him here, very little. He died in the mid-10th century. He was the last of the great classical masters whose schools perfected the early articulation of Buddhism in Zen terms. His school had an especially great impact on Korean Zen during its first three generations. And there's other little stuff that's not important. Due to confusion, people mistake things for themselves. Covetousness flares up, and they get into vicious cycles that cloud perceptions and enshroud them in ignorance. The vicious cycles go on, and people cannot be free. Now, this is where words can be misleading. Just notice this phrase. People, due to confusion, people mistake things for themselves. Well, from the perspective of oneness, there is only this one true self. What we call things, what we call trees, the moon, the pond, candles, cushions, These are just different forms of this one mind that is common to all of us. Okay, but what he's talking here more about is the ignorance of getting attached to getting attached to objects or groups or notions that we identify with. As part of our small self, ego. This is attachment, really, what he's talking about. We identify with, identify with a religion, an ethnic group, a nationality, a political party. There's just no end to the ways that we can attach to something, and then having attached to it, because there is still this attachment, then what follows from that is having to defend it through this identifying with groups or people or ideas. We identify with it, we have to defend it, and we get into conflict over it. Wars are basically all about identification, ethnic conflicts, national conflicts, religious conflicts, Iraq, the Middle East, the Balkans. It seems this to be this deep, deep human tendency to identify with something that we see as larger than ourself. And boy, does it wreak havoc in the world and with our peace of mind. Fling around words like liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans. And this can be provocative. Covetousness flares up. Again, we get into vicious cycles. The cycles go on, and people cannot be free. Of course, all of this begins with this false notion of a separate self, the I, and from the I comes the my. That's the confusion, the belief in a separate self. There's the ignorance. The purpose of Zen is to enable people to immediately transcend the ordinary and the holy, just getting people to awaken on their own, forever cutting off the root of doubt. Notice, to transcend the ordinary and the holy, which means to go beyond all notions of sacredness, holiness. Many people in modern times disregard this. Modern times for Fayan was the 9th century. They may join Zen groups, but they are lazy about Zen practice. It's easy to join a Zen center, much harder to practice regularly. But as part of a Sangha, we maybe stand a little better chance of kick-starting our practice when it stalls, of finding our way back to the mat when we're part of a community. But it does, of course, take effort, take self-discipline. The discipline, though, comes out of the experience of seeing that it works. That's the greatest way to fortify one's discipline and self-discipline in sitting, is to do it enough so we see the benefits of it. And then it's not even exactly self-discipline. It's just doing what we know we need to do, doing what we have found works, benefits ourselves and others. Just plain feels good to sit every day. Or to put it another way, it doesn't feel good when we miss a day of sitting, much less days or weeks. Then we become vulnerable to our negative habit patterns, our reactive tendencies. Here's another one. Zen is not founded or sustained on the premise that there is a doctrine to be transmitted. Okay, he's echoing Lingzhi. It is just a matter of direct guidance to the human mind, perception of its essence, and achievement of awakening. How could there be any sectarian styles to be valued? Zen is not founded or sustained on the premise there is a doctrine to be transmitted. A monk asked Zhao Zhou, "Is there any teaching in the distant mountains where no one is present?" And he said, "Large rocks are large, small rocks are small." He goes on, "There were differences in the modes of teaching set up by later Zen teachers, and there were both tradition and change. The methods employed by a number of famous Zen masters came to be continued as traditions to the point where their descendants became sectarians and did not get to the original reality. Eventually, they made many digressions, contradicting and attacking each other. They do not distinguish the profound from the superficial, and do not know that the great way has no sides and the streams of truth have the same flavor. Well, this tendency, too, seems all but inevitable when we have human beings, we imperfect human beings, practicing. But to be aware of it, to be aware of that tendency, can go a long way toward managing it, at least, if not completely eradicating it. In Japan, Japanese Zen, there's, I think, especially strong identification with a particular lineage, a particular group, to the extent that there is this kind of rivalry. Well, it is certainly present also in Western Zen, but I think maybe because of, at least in the United States, because of our great sense of individualism, we're less likely to fall prey to that, a little less likely than in Japan or maybe even in China. This is one of the this is the silver lining in our fierce identification with an individual self. The upside of it is that we're less likely to judge people by the group that they're in, more as individuals. This is where we have to bring to mind the sixth and seventh precepts. I resolve not to speak of the faults of others, and I resolve not to praise myself and disparage others, and to notice when we're slipping into disparaging other groups, other lineages. All comes down to noticing. Noticing what we're doing. Noticing what's going on in the mind. This is Zen practice. Awareness. It's really what the word Buddha means. Fundamentally, you could just say it means awareness or enlightened awareness. He goes on, Zen teachers need first to distinguish false and true, then they must clearly understand the time. This gets back to adapting the teaching, the essence of the teaching. Make it suitable. One of the ways that we, in our lineage, the Rochester Zen Center lineage, are outliers, different from other training centers, is that we don't use chopsticks. We don't use the ritual called orioki, which is the nesting bowls where the chopsticks lie on top, and you wrap it all in a cloth. And there's a very complicated prescribed ritual for, you know, untying these and using them, how they're used, how they're wiped, and Roshi Kaplow and I have always felt that whatever merits there are, practical merits to using orioki, that we feel that it's just too foreign to us. It's another cultural barrier that new people would have to surmount. is dealing with that. Now, there are new people who love those kind of things, and they have an appeal to certain people. It's the exotic. And once you've mastered their use, then you have something special that no one else has, who's not in the tradition. But here we are. Everyone else around us uses knives and forks and plates, and why should we not do that? Another thing that we have foregone is bowing ritually every time we pass one another in the hall. This was quite an eye opener for me, and when I went to Japan, actually, it wasn't so much Japan. It really wasn't. It wasn't the two temples I trained at in Japan. They didn't do that so much. But at another huge Zen center, much bigger than ours, on the West Coast, that was founded by a Japanese teacher, to walk down through a hallway in the center, you might encounter, say, eight people. Let's say you're going during a break period here at Chapin Mill, and you're going down the East Hall, and you might encounter any number of people. Each time you encounter someone, you're expected to place the hands palm to palm and make a kind of a little bit of a slight bow. Again, the case could be made that this is there's something positive about this, but it's not something we've ever felt is suitable. Gets to be seem so precious. Well, that's all I have for this master. That's one of the distinctive things about this book, is that there are so few selections for each master, so it's just a kind of a quick overview of these different masters. The next one is called Fun Yang. We're moving now through time, and now we're into the 10th and 11th centuries. There's a little bit about him here. Little factoids. He's said to have met more than 70 Zen masters and incorporated the teachings of all the major lines of Zen into his writings. Someone asked Fun Yang, "What is the work of a teaching master?" Fun Yang replied, "Impersonally guiding those with affinity." Impersonally guiding those with affinity. That's a word, impersonally, that can be misunderstood. Of course, working with a teacher is always personal in the sense that it's person to person. It's face to face. Here he means that a teacher needs to see beyond the person to the real essence of the person. And the common mind that we all have. And then we practice with those with whom we have an affinity. In fact, you could say that all of the whole teacher-student relationship is one of affinity. One master said, as far as when he was asked about teaching, he said, "I share with others what I do seriously for myself." He goes on, "The original Buddha nature of all living beings is like the bright moon in the sky. It is only because it is covered by floating clouds that it cannot appear." This is, of course, a beloved image, a metaphor for the relationship between this between host and guest. That's another distinction that from ancient China, between host being our true self and guest being this fluctuating, changing self and its behavior and changes. It's like the difference between mind with a capital M and mind with a small m, our discursive thinking mind being the floating clouds that are in constant change, and then behind these, this unmoving, eternal, beginningless and endless mind of our true nature. It's another point this Fan Yang is making. When will you ever stop competing? Before you realize it, the scenery of spring has turned to autumn. The leaves fall, the geese migrate, the frost gradually grows colder. Clothed and shod, what more do you seek? Shod meaning with shoes. So we have clothing, we have shelter, roof over our head, food. What, he asks, what more do you seek? This word competing, I've never encountered anywhere else in Zen texts, Buddhist texts. Wonder whether another translator would render it that way. We could understand that as competing as this falling into habits of conflict between self and other. There's nothing inherently wrong with competing. It makes sports fun when you keep score. It challenges us, our mental, our equanimity, our resilience, our rigor. It's when we get attached to the competition or the rivalry, and it provokes anger or other negative emotions. This is when it becomes a problem. It's only a problem because of our identification with this I and the my. our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.